I next met with Dr. Vincent Rajkumar to talk about recent clinical research in multiple myeloma, and to illustrate his points, Dr. Rajkumar brought with him several myeloma case scenarios, beginning with high-risk smoldering disease.
Recently, I saw a patient, a 48-year-old patient, with a monoclonal protein of 2.4 grams, which is kind of high, and a serum kappa free light chain level of 200 milligrams per deciliter, which is 2,000 milligrams per liter. And the serum free light chain ratio was 150. Now, these are high-risk features. And a bone marrow biopsy showed 35% plasma cells. Now, this patient is at very high risk of getting end organ damage, but at the time I saw the patient, there was no evidence of anemia or renal failure or hypercalcemia or bone lesions. So this is high-risk smoldering myeloma, and the question is, what do you do? Do you just sit and watch till the patient actually gets acute renal failure, and then you will say this patient has myeloma and treat them? Or would you say, like, the risk is so high that we should really be intervening at this point? So for years, Neil, we've watched these patients because we didn't have too many good options, and now we do. And so there's a great deal of research going on trying to see if we can identify biomarkers that tell us with high accuracy which patient is likely to progress and who is not. And this patient, for example, with such a high free light chain ratio has an 80% risk of progressing to multiple myeloma within 2 years. And so I feel like this patient needs to be treated. So there's a paradigm change developing.
You had a paper in Blood recently this fall, Smoldering Multiple Myeloma Requiring Treatment, Time for a New Definition. What were you trying to get across in that paper?
So what our group is trying to get across is that there are some features which are associated with such a high risk of progression, so that it's really not like some of these patients are going to go years before they get bone lesions. It's more like whether you want to treat in January or whether you want to treat in July. If you treat in January, you prevent some of these dangerous things from happening. You wait, then you're going to have bone disease or acute renal failure or a vertebral compression fracture before you start therapy. So there are at least three biomarkers that at present we can say, you know, if patients with smoldering myeloma have these, we should consider them as having myeloma and start therapy, regardless of whether they have these end organ damage or not. And those three features are, number one, a bone marrow that is more than 60% involved, a free light chain ratio that is 100 or more, and number three, MRI scan showing focal lesions. Now, there are many others that are going to come down the pike in the next few months to a few years that will add to this list of criteria that really define ultra-high-risk smoldering myeloma, in other words, multiple myeloma requiring therapy.
What about interventions? Most of what I've seen has been IMIDs, particularly lenalidomide. Can you talk about what we know?
Well, one of the reasons why we are more confident about making these changes is the fact that there was a randomized trial published last year in the New England Journal of Medicine, where the Spanish group took high-risk smoldering myeloma patients and randomized them to lenalidomide low-dose dexamethasone versus observation. They found not only a prolongation in time to progression, but also an overall survival advantage. There are some caveats to the study in the sense that the definitions used for high-risk in the Spanish trial are not widely available, but it gives us confidence that early therapy is not going to be harmful. It can actually potentially save lives. And we do have a trial going on in the US looking at lenalidomide versus observation for high-risk patients. So I would encourage people to participate in that trial. If patients have very high-risk features, like ultra-high-risk, like I mentioned, those patients should really be treated as myeloma. And that's not just lenalidomide low-dose dexamethasone. That's just the full treatment like we use for multiple myeloma, which is some form of induction, transplantation, and so on.
What are the entry criteria for the trial? I think you're talking about the ECOG study.
That's correct. The ECOG study looks at high-risk smoldering myeloma, defined simply as patients should have 10% or more plasma cells in the bone marrow. They should have measurable monoclonal protein levels, and they should have an abnormal free light chain ratio. With these criteria, the risk of progression is about 20% per year. it's still quite high. That means 50% of patients will progress within 2 years. A cohort that very closely resembles the Spanish trial. And you may ask, why do we need another trial? Well, without this trial, we actually cannot use lenalidomide to treat myeloma in any country other than the US, because a regulatory agency is not going to accept a lenalidomide plus dexamethasone regimen as proof that lenalidomide works. Lenalidomide is the more expensive of the two drugs, and they would need proof that lenalidomide has activity as a single agent. Secondly, there are some caveats to the Spanish trial. There were some age differences between the two cohorts. There were questions about the eligibility criteria. And so we do need a confirmatory trial to say that lenalidomide is indeed useful in high-risk smoldering myeloma.
So let's talk about your second patient, and this is a scenario, a 78-year-old patient. Can you kind of go through that?
Yes, and you know, I picked this patient to discuss because there was a very large phase 3 trial that was presented at the annual meeting of the American Society of Hematology in December. And this was an international trial led by the French group. Thierry Facon was the first author, and he gave it as a plenary presentation. And this was a 1,600 patient trial that looked at melphalan, prednisone, thalidomide as the control arm and lenalidomide, dexamethasone as the experimental arm, where there were two lenalidomide, dexamethasone arms, one where the treatment was limited to 18 months and one where it was given continuously till progression. What they found was an overall survival improvement with lenalidomide and low-dose dexamethasone. It's the first time a non-melphalan-containing regimen has beaten a melphalan-containing regimen in multiple myeloma in the elderly patient setting. And so the comment was made by the presenter as well as the commentary that was given by Dr. San Miguel that len-low-dose dexamethasone represents a new standard of care for the elderly patient with multiple myeloma. And it's a very important trial, particularly outside the U.S. In the U.S., melphalan's never been used, at least in the last 5-10 years, for even elderly patients. I mean, the proportion of elderly patients getting melphalan-based therapy as the first line in the U.S. has dropped to like 2% or so. So the study already has less relevance here. Outside the U.S., though, melphalan-containing regimens are the standard of care, and this study just changes that. So in an elderly patient right now, the more elderly they are, the lenalidomide low-dose dexamethasone regimen is a really good option because its oral therapy can be taken comfortably and is associated with improved survival. And the patient that I have with trisomies, the 78-year-old patient with trisomies, is particularly good candidate for lenalidomide low-dose dexamethasone. The same elderly patient, though, if they had, say, some high-risk cytogenetic features like 414 or 1416 or 1420, or deletion 17P would be more of a candidate for a bortezomib-based regimen, such as bortezomib cyclophosphamide dexamethasone or Cybord.
So, you know, one other thing about that plenary presentation, as you mentioned, you know, the U.S. people maybe weren't sort of quite as interested, but there was a facet that I thought was interesting and maybe relevant, which is there were actually three arms there, because one arm they got 18 months and the other they got it until progression. Can you talk about the findings there and what you thought it meant?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's fascinating. First of all, it shows that a well-tolerated doublet can beat a triplet. Number two, it shows us that lenalidomide low-dose dexamethasone, unlike other myeloma treatments that we use, is a chronic suppressive regimen. The 18-month arm had a time to progression of about 20 months. That means you stop therapy and immediately the disease bounces back. So it is a regimen, if you choose to use it, needs to be given on a chronic suppressive schedule for a long time until progression occurs. And when you do that, it was associated with improved overall survival. So one may ask, why can't we give MPT like that? Well, you cannot, because it will cause acute leukemia or MDS fairly quickly and it'll damage the bone marrow forever. So what they did was compare the best you can do with MPT, which is give it for 18 months, with what you could do with len low-dose dex, which is give it till progression. And they showed that giving it till progression was associated with better survival. Now, I think if time passes, there will be a survival advantage when you compare the 18 months len dex versus the continuous therapy. It's just that it's too short a follow-up to see that difference. But I think one will emerge.
So, you know, when you get up into 75 and 80, I'm curious what your thinking is now, both in terms of selection of agents, but also duration of treatment in the older patient.
Right. I think if the patient is not transplant eligible, so you're talking generally anybody over the age of 72, 73, or people younger but with poor performance status due to some other comorbidities. In those patients, the regimens that we tend to use are len low-dose dexamethasone for standard risk patients and a bortezomib-based regimen such as cyclophosphamide bortezomib dex or Cybord or bortezomib len dex VRD for the high risk and the intermediate risk patients. As far as duration of therapy, for the standard risk patients, if we are going to use len low-dose dex, I would give it till progression. You could use one of the bortezomib-based regimens as well, but if you do that, then you usually give the treatment for about 12 to 18 months and stop, because beyond that, it would cause long-term neuropathy or long-term bone marrow damage from the other drugs. So that's generally kind of our principle. For very high-risk patients, we do use some form of maintenance, probably bortezomib-based rather than lenalidomide-based.
Earlier, you mentioned the MLN compound, which I think has a name of exazimib, I believe, right now. And I'm curious what your thoughts are. And there's another one, I think, that's similar to carfilzomib in terms of these types of agents and whether you see them kind of fitting in better with a maintenance type approach.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, for many reasons. I mean, I always worry about cost. And when you have five proteasome inhibitors available, one way to say is, well, they're all me too drugs, but no, not really. If you have multiple drugs, the cost will come down because there's going to be competition. Number two, each drug has a different side effect profile and a different mode of administration. One is sub-Q, one is IV, one is oral. And so for different patients, you could choose it depending on the side effect profile and the mode of administration. And finally, some of them work in patients where the other one doesn't. And so you do get some non-cross resistance as well. So, for example, carfilzomib works in patients who fail bortezomib. I'm sure there's vice versa as well. MLN-9708 or ixazomib is particularly of interest because it's a once-weekly pill, which would make it very much a good drug for compliance, particularly elderly patients. They're already taking other medications. If you have a pill that you need to take once a week, that would really enhance compliance. It's well tolerated at the right doses. I am involved with the newly diagnosed trial. I'm one of the principal investigators, which is comparing Lendex versus MLN-9708 plus Lendex. It's a phase 3 international trial. And then there is a maintenance trial also planned with MLN-9708. Again, because it's an oral once a week regimen, it lends itself good for a maintenance strategy.
When you think about that agent, ixazomib, do you kind of think about it as sort of an, I know it's not exactly like bortezomib, but it is a boron-related proteasome inhibitor. Do you kind of pretty much think about it the same as bortezomib in terms of, for example, cross-resistance?
I don't know. I mean, it's going to take some more trials to tell us. There's probably some extra activity that we have seen with 9708 in the relapse refractory trials. But yes, I mean, it probably is just another version of bortezomib, but its side effect profile seems different. It doesn't have that much neuropathy, so it will have a place. And its oral administration will also have a place in the sense it's more difficult to use bortezomib once a week or twice a week long term as maintenance, whereas a once weekly oral regimen would be a more attractive maintenance strategy. But yes, in terms of non-cross resistance or cross resistance, it's probably a different level than, say, carfilzomib, which is a completely different proteasome inhibitor and has a documented activity in patients refractory to bortezomib.
So I wanted to ask you another sort of very practical question. We actually just completed a survey of 100 U.S.-based oncologists and a variety of tumors. We asked quite a bit about myeloma. One thing I was really curious about was how they administer bortezomib and to what extent they've switched over sub-Q, because we've seen that in the investigators. I was quite interested to find that they seem like they've almost totally switched over to sub-Q, including in the induction setting for pre-transplant patients. Is that what you're doing?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, sub-Q is the default, unless for some reason the patient's got some, you know, side effects when you give it sub-Q in the skin, like skin reactions. We generally use sub-Q, and that's what I preferred. And the reason is quite simple. There was a randomized trial, even though it was in the relapse setting, and even though it was in the twice weekly setting, it showed that when you give it sub-Q, the neuropathy rate is much lower, particularly the severe neuropathy rate. Gone are the days when patients would take bortezomib and have to put their feet in cold water to prevent the paresthesias or the dysesthesias. It's, in fact, we have learned to use bortezomib so well now that it's the biggest threat to 9708. In the sense, like, now you can give bortezomib so easily, once a week sub-Q, and patients can take it for not just months, but years. So the default that I use is usually once weekly sub-Q, unless there's a need for emergent response, in which we go twice weekly IV for the first two cycles and then switch.
And when you talk about the need for a quick response, one situation I've heard people talk about is renal failure.
Yes, acute renal failure, you want to go twice weekly IV, as well as give the dex pulsed, you know, 4 days straight. The other situations are like cord compression, multiple extramedullary plasmacytomas, where we tend to use like a regimen like VDT PACE, which is a twice weekly IV regimen. Those plasma cell leukemia, any of those conditions where the response needs to be achieved quickly, rapidly, which is probably only like 10% of the time in myeloma.
Let's talk about your third patient, the 66-year-old woman with T1114.
Yeah, I wanted to throw in a patient that we can discuss who's a young patient, a transplant-eligible patient, and, you know, how do we approach such a patient. This particular patient is standard risk because of the 1114 translocation. Just, you know, before I proceed with the case, the way we define risk is usually based on cytogenetics. As you know, prognosis in myeloma depends on, like any other cancer, on four factors: the host characteristics, whether the patient's age, performance status, comorbidities, how much tumor they have, which is stage, how aggressive is the tumor, the disease biology, and then how well do they respond to the therapy. If everything is equal, though, the outcome is dictated by disease biology. Certain patients seem to do really well regardless of how you treat them and what sequence you use the drugs. These are patients with trisomies 1114 or 614. Then on the other extreme, there are patients with deletion 17p, 1416 or 1420, and these are high-risk patients, and they don't seem to do well. They have a median survival of 2 to 3 years, even when you use an Arkansas approach, which is basically give everything up front. VDT PACE, two transplants, VRD maintenance for 3 years, and then you look at the survival, and it's like median 2 to 3 years. So that's a different set of patients. And then in between, in the intermediate risk group, you have the patients with T414. This is a really unique group because they used to do badly with prognosis similar to 17p deletion. But now they're doing almost as well as the standard risk, provided you use a bortezomib-based regimen for induction and then use it in maintenance. So the patient that I described there, the two questions that will come up is, you know, what is your choice of induction therapy? This patient is 66, has a standard risk disease. Generally in the US, people are using VRD for all patients. At Mayo, though, we are more using a risk stratified approach. We use Lendex or CyBorD for standard risk. We use CyBorD for 414 patients, and then we use the VRD regimen mainly for the high risk patients, mainly driven by, you know, cost and toxicity concerns. And the fact that VRD is still not proven. It's, after all, a regimen that has only two phase two trials supporting its use, and it happens to be also the most expensive. So that's the induction question. But the more important thing is, you know, okay, you've had a young patient and you've given induction, whatever the induction is, and then you've done the transplant and now they are in complete response. Now, what do you do? Do you just give maintenance therapy or do you just watch the patient? And if you give maintenance, which drug would you use? Lenalidomide, bortezomib, both? These are all important questions. Not all of them have answers. There were two phase three trials published in the New England Journal looking at lenalidomide maintenance. And one of them showed a survival benefit. One of them has not yet shown a survival benefit. But after the publication of these trials, in general, most people in the US would recommend maintenance therapy with lenalidomide for all patients after transplant. Some of us are still holding back, and we don't recommend for all patients, primarily because there is a risk of second cancers that was seen in all the lenalidomide maintenance trials. The survival benefit is inconsistent. It is seen only in one trial, the US trial, and it's not seen in the French trial. And then you ask, why was it seen in the U.S. trial? Well, in the U.S. trial, it was seen primarily in the patients who got Len induction. So you knew exactly how they're going to respond to Len, and you knew that they were responding well and tolerating well. That's the group that had the biggest survival impact. The other point to make about the U.S. trial was that impact was also seen only in patients who were not in complete response. If patients already had a complete response with transplant, they did not see a survival benefit even in the U.S. trial. So in practice in our group for standard risk patients, if the patient's already done really well with transplant, we generally just don't do routine maintenance. On the other hand, if the patients have not achieved a very good partial response with transplant, then those are the patients we consider maintenance with lenalidomide. So we try to minimize the risk for the patients already in CR, such as this patient in this case. For intermediate and high-risk patients, although lenalidomide can be used, there are data supporting that such patients do particularly well when bortezomib is used as maintenance, particularly the HOVON trial, where patients with 17P got a survival benefit with bortezomib-based maintenance, and other studies supporting maintenance for 414 patients with bortezomib. So we kind of like risk adapt and risk stratify how we use the maintenance. We use Len maintenance for standard risk if patients have not done well with the transplant. If they are in CR or VGPR, we just watch them. For intermediate and high-risk patients, we use a bortezomib-based maintenance. If you do choose maintenance, we stop after 2 years because that's when the risk of second cancer seemed to really take off.
So when you use bortezomib maintenance, is that by itself or with lenalidomide?
We use it generally by itself or with Cybord, and we use it on a lower dose schedule, like the HOVON trial did every other week schedule.
And I guess in terms of, you know, those two trials that you talked about, CLGB and the French study, which I guess got updated at ASH, and there was another study, an Italian study, I think that did show a survival benefit. But one thing that I have heard people talk about is in the U.S. trial, they used the maintenance until progression, whereas the French stopped it after 2 years. Also that the French used a two-month consolidation in the control, quote, non-maintenance group. Any thoughts about that?
Oh, two excellent points and definitely need clarification. You know, when somebody says that the French trial treated patients only for 2 years, whereas the U.S. trial treated at progression and that's why there's a survival difference, they really haven't read the papers carefully. That's not the data. The CALGB trial showed a survival benefit at a time when the median duration that they had given of maintenance was 12 months less than what the French had given. The French gave maintenance for a whole year extra, and they didn't see a survival benefit. At the same time, the CALGB trial was seeing a survival benefit. So it was not because the French stopped the maintenance early. They were just not seeing it. When the U.S. trial, with a median duration of maintenance 12 months less than the French, found a survival benefit, they actually crossed over all patients, or at least recommended a crossover. So from that time point onwards, actually, it's difficult to look for a survival signal between the two arms. So I don't think that is the reason. The reason is probably the second one that you said, which is they use consolidation. When you use consolidation, what happens is, particularly in the French trial, where most patients had never seen lenalidomide before, they probably got most of the bang for their buck with that. And my answer to that is just what Michel et al. Said at ASH. If you can neutralize the survival benefit of 2 years of Len maintenance with 2 months of consolidation, why wouldn't you do the 2 months consolidation? And so that's actually what the Mayo Clinic now recommends in our MSMART algorithm is 2 months of consolidation, because that approach seems to have neutralized the maintenance benefit. We do recommend maintenance, but it's for patients who are not in VGPR after their transplant.
So a couple sort of general questions related to the scenario of the younger patient. The first, it kind of brings up this issue of what the objective of treatment is and whether there's a benefit to drive the tumor burden down as low as possible, MRD. There's a whole group of people. Sagar Loniel has his iceberg graphic that we've seen a few times now. And then there's another point of view, which I think, you know, I see you representing and other people, which you've just described. Can you kind of talk about what your thoughts are about this concept of driving the tumor burden down and going for prolonged survival, maybe even cure?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, some people think that I'm more for disease control and not for cure. That's actually not the case. I really would like to cure multiple myeloma, and I think the way to cure it is the same strategies that people are advocating. Use all the best treatments early in the disease course, try and get a CR, try and get MRD negative, and maintain it for as long as possible. In fact, Shahji Kumar and I led a four-drug combination trial years ago that was published in Blood, the Evolution trial, where we really wanted to look at that with bortezomib, len, dex, and cyclophosphamide all given together. The difference, though, is what we do in clinical trials versus what we do in practice. In the research setting, we want to explore, can we cure myeloma? And those patients sign an informed consent, and we're willing to do everything possible, you know, the best approach possible. However, just because I think I can get MRD negative with carfilzomib len dex, and I can get even more MRD negative if I give two transplants and then give some more carfilzomib len dex, doesn't mean that I then start saying that that's what people should do outside a trial and practice. My hypothesis that that will cure patients still needs to be verified in a trial. And in outside a trial setting, we still should do the first do no harm approach, which is use proven methods of treatment. Otherwise, what happens is we always know the result of a phase three before it starts. And in the US, we never do any good phase three trials in a timely manner. Nothing accrues because everybody seems to know the answer before the trial's done.
I want to finish out talking a little bit about relapse refractory disease and particularly new agents, including carfilzomib, pomalidomide, but also agents coming along, particularly the monoclonal antibodies. I see that you wrote a review article a few months ago on pomalidomide. Can you kind of comment on what we know about that agent and right now how you're using it in your own practice?
Yes, pomalidomide is definitely active, and it probably has a response rate of 25% or so in patients refractory to other IMIDs, as well as bortezomib. So it's a very valuable treatment to have in our armamentarium. It combines really well with low-dose dexamethasone, and palm low-dose dex is an extremely well-tolerated regimen, just like Lendex. Sometimes people say it may be even easier to give than len low-dose dexamethasone. So it's a highly active regimen. And since that came around, we have found that it's actually combines well with carfilzomib. So the carfilzomib palm dex regimen that Brian Dury and others presented, it works really, really well as well. As well as the pomalidomide cyclophosphamide prednisone regimen that Antonio Palumbo presented. So now we have learned that, you know, when you do want to go to pomalidomide and the patient's already failed bortezomib, lenalidomide, and all the other drugs, if you just use palm or palm dex, you may not get the response you need. So we have learned now to tailor the therapy and use appropriate combinations, and we have at least a few now that there's experience with, you know, car palm dex, carfilzomib, pomalidomide, cyclophosphamide, prednisone, palm low-dose dex to work around. I think this is a drug that is safe, orally available, orally effective, valuable addition to the myeloma treatment. I use it primarily in patients who have failed lenalidomide and bortezomib.
How do you decide between, for example, pomalidomide and carfilzomib?
I think it's just at that moment, sometimes we may be even using both together. So it's really at that moment what you think the patients previously responded to and what you think is likely, you know, the response rate going to be for palm versus carfilzomib. But I tell companies also, don't worry about, you know, how the exact sequence is. It really doesn't matter. Since myeloma is not curable, if a patient starts with palm, when that stops working, people will have to use carfilzomib and vice versa. So it's not a disease where if you use one, the other is not going to get used.
Let's chat a little bit about carfilzomib, and I'm curious. I see you're involved with a trial looking at carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, the so-called CRD regimen. But first, I'm kind of curious about where we are today in terms of side effects and toxicity. I've heard about issues, maybe cardiac issues, dyspnea, pulmonary issues. I haven't been completely clear about what's going on. What's your take on that?
You know, carfilzomib is, again, just like pomalidomide, a really important drug, a really important addition. First, because it does have a safety profile that's different from bortezomib, less neuropathy. It also has activity in patients truly refractory to bortezomib. So I forget the percentage, but it's probably like 20% in that phase 2 trial that had failed bortezomib but responded to carfilzomib. And again, these are studies that actually use probably suboptimal doses of carfilzomib, 20, 27 milligrams per meter squared. And now we know we can go up on the dose to 56 or even higher. And so you could probably salvage more patients who are failing bortezomib with higher doses of carfilzomib. So it's going to be a very useful drug. We've also learned, just like pomalidomide, learned how to combine it with other agents like carfilzomib Lendex, carfilzomib Pomdex. And the thing that we need to keep in mind is that when you do a regulatory trial, you're trying to show the agency that it has single agent activity. So the response rate you see is 20%. But when we have the drug on the market and we are able to fine tune it to the patient, I'm not expecting a 20% response rate. I can expect much higher because I can vary the dose, add other drugs that are effective, and then improve the response rate. As far as the side effects go, I think it's a very well-tolerated agent. Many of the initial problems, like, you know, renal problems and all that, have been solved by the dosing and the fluid administration. There's a worry about cardiac side effects or pulmonary side effects with carfilzomib. I have personally seen patients with this, like, right at the bedside. So it is something that I pay attention to, and we need to get a real handle on both what is the frequency as well as what is the exact mechanism of this thing. You have to understand that when you don't have a control arm, it's very difficult to know exactly what is drug-related and what would have happened anyway because you're giving some infusion. I think the Lendex placebo versus carfilzomib Lendex trial will allow me to get a good handle on the frequency with which this problem happens. Is it 5%, 10%? We still don't know because we are looking at single-arm trials and we don't know whether those patients, these are patients who have already had multiple relapses. And so you don't know exactly in what shape they are in and whether some of this is infusion-related, IV fluid-related, or carfilzomib-related. So I would just urge caution till we get a good handle on the exact frequency and the mechanism. The final point I want to make with regards to carfilzomib is the neuropathy rate. I mean, it does seem to be lower, but one caveat is that many of the carfilzomib trials did exclude patients with pre-existing neuropathy. And so you have to be fair to bortezomib in the sense that a true rate of what this neuropathy risk is will need more studies where carfilzomib is used ahead of bortezomib. And then finally, you know, it is because of these concerns that there is a safety concern that one should be cautious about suddenly switching to carfilzomib Lendex as your newly diagnosed regimen, just because two phase 2 trials show high MRD. You know, high MRD doesn't mean patients are going to live longer. That requires proof in a phase 3 trial. A phase 3 trial comparing bortezomib Lendex versus carfilzomib Lendex is available across the US. It's an intergroup trial, CALGB, SWOG, ECOG. That kind of trial is necessary before we conclude that one regimen is better than the other. You just simply cannot compare two phase 2 trials. Otherwise, we will end up with problems and not even know that we are having one.
So just for practical purposes, though, if you have an otherwise healthy patient who's, you know, 85 or 90, do you do any kind of cardiac screening before starting carfilzomib?
I think it'll be wise to, just because there are some questions. We don't know whether it's a direct cardiac effect or a pulmonary effect, but it's worthwhile checking. You know, to be honest, I think some of the carfilzomib trials are incorporating an echocardiogram now routinely to get a handle on this situation. We just need a little bit more data, but while waiting for that, why not be proactive in elderly patients and make sure you got good cardiac function? At least you may still do the treatment, but you can monitor.
You mentioned the trials looking at CRD up front. Any comments on what's been seen there?
Very good response rates, CR rates, stringent CR rates, very high in both the NCI study as well as the Jakubowiak study. However, again, the same caution I would make, how long a patient lives is not just depending on efficacy, it's also depending on safety. And phase 2 trials are mere hypothesis. It doesn't mean truth. I mean, to get at the truth, you really need a phase 3 trial. We made the mistake already with BRD, where we have got half the country using a regimen that is not proven by phase 3 trials. We don't want to make the same mistake over and over again. We'll never learn if we do that.
So I want to finish out just talking about new agents in myeloma, and I want to begin with monoclonal antibodies, elotuzumab, daratumumab, and I think there's another one without a name that's similar to daratumumab, an anti-CD38.
Well, one of the things that we've been bothered by for a long time was that even with the new agents, everything was just another IMiD or another proteasome inhibitor. We really need some other class of agent to be active in order to cure multiple myeloma. Because Barlogy has already tried all these IMiDs and proteasome inhibitors and transplant and everything else. We just need new classes of agents. And one of the exciting things is that we have these new monoclonal antibodies. One is elotuzumab, which is an anti-CS1 antibody. And anti-CD38, there are two monoclonal antibodies, and they're all in clinical trials. Elotuzumab does not have single agent activity to speak of. However, the response rate when combined with lenalidomide seems to be so impressive that the company and other investigators have embarked on phase 3 trials looking at elotuzumab. There's a phase 3 in the newly diagnosed setting, Lendex plus elotuzumab versus Lendex, and a very similar phase 3 in the relapse setting. I'm really looking forward to those two to see if this drug will actually be active, and a victory in one of those trials is required to get the drug approved. The CD38 monoclonal antibodies is a different story. I'm much more optimistic that one or both of them will get approved eventually because they have single agent activity, clear partial responses with just the antibody alone in relapsed refractory disease. So it's very promising. Again, phase 3s are starting off and looking forward to that.